This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining me this afternoon as we take a look at the stories and events that affected the tri-state this week, Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, 9 on Your Side, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner, and later in the show, WVXU radio and TV writer John Keysweater on the passing of Channel 12's Tim Hedrick. We'd like to hear your thoughts as well on this week's news and how it was covered by local media. 513-419-7100, the phone number to call. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tana, Chris, and Dan, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invite.
Thanks.
Chris, let's start talking about the shootings in Pike County. We have 8 family members. Very tragic thing here. 8 family members shot to death on April the 22nd. They're members of the Roden family. How much more do we really know at this point about what happened?
It is true that there were 8 members shot to death in 4 different locations. So what we know at this point is not a lot. The investigation is underway. I talked to Attorney General Mike DeWine about an hour before this. He's still extraordinarily tight-lipped. The most recent activity from the crime scenes have been they've been taking cars off of the property, but no one will say why. So there's 3 to 5 to 7 cars that have been taken off the larger property out in Pike County. All the burials have happened now. So DeWine said that there were about 22 members of his office with multiple Pike County sheriff's deputies there. So the investigation is still sort of a beehive and buzzing and lots of crime scene. They haven't released Union Hill Road, which is where the multiple 3 of the 4 scenes are. So that's still being guarded by multiple sheriff's deputies. So that's about it.
You got really a pretty vast investigation going on here, it sounds like.
Yeah. Hundreds of pieces of evidence. Everything they've taken, as I said, they've taken cars. I would guess they've taken trace evidence up to the crime labs. Again, the authorities have locked this investigation down. It's hard to get information about it. Certainly the family members have various theories, but nothing's confirmed at this point.
They're all just theories at this point.
Right. That's right.
Now, you said Union Hill Road. Where exactly in Pike County did this occur?
So, interestingly, it's right on the border of Adams and Pike County, right on the lines. In fact, part of the property, if you stand in one part, 1 foot in one and one in the other, it is right on the county line and a little bit of Scioto County as well when you sort of meander down. But right off of, if you drive out east on 32, Union Hill Road is literally, if you're driving east to the right and up and around and in the hills.
Now, and this happened at several different sites, right? Several different homes. How close were the homes?
So the first 3 locations that are actually on Union Hill Road are about a mile and a half. The scene 1 is about a mile and a half to scene 2. Scene 3 is about 500 feet from scene 2. And then the 4th location is about 3.5 miles, and it's not on Union Hill Road. It's on Left Fork Road, which is you'd really have to know where you were going to find it.
Now, what's the community like where this happened? I'd imagine being in a rural area, this is a very tight-knit community, isn't it?
It is. Most everybody that I've talked to, which at this point is probably dozens upon dozens, if you say the Roden family or the Manley family, which is the other family tree of this, everybody knows them or knows of them through somebody else. Sort of small community, about 23,000, pretty poor. You know, it's right on sort of right at the beginning of Appalachia and really I think the second poorest county in Ohio. Not a lot of economy down there. Lots of drug dealing, lots of crime. Not crime so much as marijuana. You've heard about the marijuana grow sites and all that. I talked to a law enforcement officer just this morning who talked about sort of between 32 and 23 that those are major sort of drug corridors, bringing drugs in and money out both ways. So now whether or not drugs have anything to do with this, there's been tons of speculation.
I was going to ask because that's an area where opiate and heroin's a big problem too.
Right, right. I talked with him about that sort of opiates really sort of exploding there about 2007 and then really took hold 2009. And, you know, it's all about which is cheaper. Right now, heroin's cheaper than the pills. You know, pills are probably 10 to 15 times as expensive as heroin. So heroin, but that's true here, too. Not just a problem for Pike County, obviously.
Yeah, so this being a rural area, how locked down do authorities have this? It's
pretty tight. It's pretty tight. There's a lot of rumors, lots of rumors, lots of speculation, lots of, well, so-and-so was involved with such and such. And but what really is happening, I think law enforcement has a couple of theories, but I can't tell you what those are. I mean, they're pretty definitive about, yes, there will be an arrest. I asked the attorney general that again about an hour ago, and he said, yep, there'll be an arrest. I don't know when, but there'll be an arrest. It's a definitive.
Why do you think they're taking cars out of the site? Am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah, of course you are, Dan. You're part of our panel here. Jump in.
That's a great question. I think they're looking for anything and everything, you know, and the cars that they're taking, according to one of the family members, are around Chris Roden's, if there is a patriarch of this family, it would be Chris Sr. And it's around sort of his trailer. So these are, we call them homes, but they're trailers. I don't know. They're looking for something. I don't know. I don't know. Tire tracks? People in and out? You know, I wish I knew.
And how many,
I wish I knew.
How many cars at this point did you say?
Well, I know for sure 3 to 5. Somebody else told me they'd taken 2 before that we were. I drove past and saw three beds, and then the attorney general confirmed that they were taken 3 to 5. And then, again, one of the other family members said they had taken 2 before, so I'd guess anywhere from 3 to 7.
These guys were demolition derby enthusiasts? Could that possibly have anything to do with
why
they'd
be taking these cars? Yeah.
I don't know. But I doubt that, just my opinion, I doubt that you and I elate an entire family over demolition derby. I could be wrong, but maybe. I don't know.
So it also sounds, too, Chris, like if Attorney General Mike DeWine is talking about there will be an arrest in this, that they have somebody in mind.
He's not said that. He said that he's pretty sure that there will be an arrest. He will not speculate on when that will be or who it will be or why it will be or what a motive is. Lots of non-answers on this one, which is frustrating.
Mm. What's been the reaction of the community to this tragic event? How's the community feeling?
Do you have
a sense of that?
Yeah. I think everybody knows everybody. So it's everybody went to school with somebody, so I think that it sounds trite, but I think they're sad for the families mm-hmm. left behind. Certainly the mothers and fathers of the victims who are slightly older. Geneva Roden, who's sort of the matriarch of the Roden boys, Chris and Kenneth, two of the victims, and then her 3 grandchildren and her daughter-in-law were killed in this. Has lost, I believe this is her 3rd son who's been killed. He should have lost a 13-year-old boy years ago. He would drown. So everybody, I think, in that family has sort of circled her and just feel awful. I mean, the funerals, I was at both of them.
Yeah, describe that to this. They just buried the final 6 of the 8 this week, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, what was that like?
That's correct. I've covered a fair amount of funerals in my career. It was sorrowful. It was, and I wrote about this, but Geneva Roden, I will never, ever get the mournful moans and cries out of my head. It was heartbreaking, you know. I mean, she was looking at 6 caskets in front of her, you know, for a half hour and then buried 5 of them and then returned the next day to another cemetery to bury her other boy next to his son, who had died, I believe, from cancer. I don't exactly know which cancer, but lots of death. So I think there's that. I think there's curiosity. So I think now that the sorrow and what the heck happened here, the curiosity, it's a big mystery, you know, for many people. Again, there's lots of speculation. There's lots of online talk. There's lots of Facebook back and forth. But you know, obviously the Attorney General's got lots of pieces of evidence. What those evidence show us, I don't know. I wish I did. I'm trying.
Could I jump in with another question of my own?
You're a part of the panel, too. Can I go right ahead?
So I just kind of wanted to get your take on, Mark asked about how the people, how the community are. And I saw an interesting op-ed from a former journalist that's in that area now. And he said, you know, they feel like their area, which is in the foothills of Appalachia, has just been depicted as redneck and backward and country. And just if you want to address that sense, he said that's not who we are.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I will tell you near the end of middle of this week, end of last week, we were the larger media sort of gaggle was, you know, lots of profanities leveled at us. And, you know, they feel it's an insular community. And I think when you have the international media there and the national media, they feel very under the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. What people have told me both at where I stayed at the hotel and in the coffee shops and restaurants is, you know, this is not what we want to be known for. We're good people down here. We work hard. You know, we feed our families just like everybody else does. We're not backwards. We're not, we're just like you are. We just live in a different place. And I think it's beautiful. I think the people, I've been treated just wonderfully by everybody.
Has this tragedy really drawn them together as a community?
That's a great question. I think that it's drawn them together, as Hannah said, because they feel like there's a bunch of outsiders. So I think they've drawn together as they don't understand who we are. I think there are likely people in the community who know some things who aren't saying.
How much cooperation are the authorities getting from local people?
They've said that they've interviewed, you know, over 100 people. I think – I forget what the last count is. But I think people are – you know, there are lots of tips. I mean, it isn't like it's dried up. It isn't like up here in the urban area we hear, you know – no snitching and that. I don't think that's going on there. I think they're getting cooperation. I don't know if it's the right cooperation from the right people, but I think they're getting cooperation. There's, as I said, there's lots of rumors, and I'm sure, you know, the dozens and dozens of folks there are filtering through.
How much, when you're talking about national media, how much of the national, international media have descended on the town?
You know, TV, so CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, I believe, was all there. The Daily Mail had been there. I left yesterday, and
the UK Daily Mail.
Yeah,
okay.
And they were still there, and they were covering a lot. They showed up a lot. They don't look like they fit in there, so they're easy to spot, as you might imagine. You know, it was pretty intense for the first week, and then people started pulling out. I mean, we're still there in various capacities, and I'm going to head back this weekend again. So we're pretty committed to the story, pretty committed to trying to figure out what happened there.
How much time have you been spending out that way?
I think in the last 14 days, I've been physically there for 10 or 11, depending on how you count hours. But yeah.
But there's a lot to this story and still a lot of things we just don't know.
There are indeed, you know, lots of questions that we're looking for answers on. And, you know, it takes a while. And I know that readers here and your listeners probably want answers. What happened? How did that happen? What's going on? How come you guys aren't doing more? It's just, you know, we also don't want to get in the, you know, hinder an investigation. That's not what I'm about. You know, we don't want to get in the middle of everything, and nor do we want to just feed the rumor and speculation mill. But it's lots of questions.
So no arrests at this point, but how concerned are people in the community about their own safety?
You know, I hear various things. There are some people who say, well, you know, I'm just fine. I think a lot of people are hunters. A lot of people are armed. As you recall, the sheriff, who's a great guy and is from there, he's a native from there, been in law enforcement for 20 or 25 years, you know, told everybody to arm themselves. That's just part of the culture. You know, lots of hunters. So I think there's a little bit of a feeling like if anybody messes with me, you know, they're going to, you know, it won't end well for them. I also think that many people also think this was fairly targeted because that's what authorities have said. So I don't know if they think there's – I don't necessarily think they think there's a killer on the loose.
Right. To me, it sounds like it was – something personal was going on here. Yeah. That it's something that, to that extent.
Right. I mean, you've got eight people of the same family – all targeted, you know, boom, 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 three locations in close proximity, a fourth location not that far, many of them shot multiple times. I think it's personal. I think it's targeted. I think the people knew what they were doing, you know. I mean, a lot of this stuff has been out there, but, you know, the doors were locked, or at least two of the doors were locked when the people who found them, the family members who found them, found them. The dogs had been let out of the trailer. So there's lots of sort of eyebrow raising about what that might mean.
513-419-7100. Jim in Hyde Park joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm calling because after World War II, my father came back from Europe. We moved all over the country, but we moved from Washington, D.C. to Jackson, Ohio, which is about 20 miles from Piketon. So I moved there in the seventh grade, and, you know, I hate the word Appalachia. I'm a hillbilly. I hate the word Appalachia. And I'll tell you one thing. It is a different culture. It's one, I'm not going to say a bad word, it's a great culture. It's a very private culture. It's a very independent culture. It's southeastern Ohio is different from anything in the rest of Ohio. It is a culture unto itself. It is very private. It is very proud. And people, even in Jackson where I live, do resent people dropping in. Now, this was a terrible thing that happened.
Oh, yeah.
And I have no
can't deny that,
about
yeah.
that. But your friends on the radio recognize it is a very private, very independent, ornery culture, but wonderful people. I mean, just wonderful. And I hate the term Appalachia. You know, I'm not a hillbilly, although I was born in Cincinnati and left when I was 3 years old. I'm a hillbilly, and I lived in Jackson, Ohio for many years before I went away from college.
Yeah.
And your folks have got it right.
Well, let's Chris say something about this. So thanks, Jim. We really do appreciate the call. Thanks much.
You're welcome. Right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I agree completely. I had a long interview with Leonard Manley, who's the father of Dana Roden, who the family tree gets a little confusing, but one of the victims, we'll just say it that. And he lives about a mile and a half away from the first crime scene and 3 miles from the second and third crime scenes. You know, and I think he put it the best. I was up there interviewing him, and he said, literally, he said, you know, we're just a bunch of hillbillies. And I said, and I sort of turned to him and I said, well, Leonard, you guys aren't hillbillies. He said, and he just sort of busted me and said, what's wrong with being a hillbilly? And I thought, you know, and I thought that was telling because I was bringing my own sort of experience and my background and my, if you will, city sort of sensibilities, if you will, there. And to those folks, that's not a bad thing. It's who they are. As a caller mentioned, they are very, very, very proud of their families and what they do and where they come from. It's very much, you know, as anybody who's been there, I mean, multi-generational people often don't. I mean, many people leave, but there are multi-generations there, you know, who've lived on the same land for a long time, who come from the same. And there's a feeling of pride, and that's what I meant by the insular. We can take care of ourselves, and we're proud of that. And how dare somebody do this to our community? How dare somebody do this to my family?
Chris, any idea mm-hmm. where the investigation heads at this point? Do you have any sense of where this is going?
I don't. I mean, I think they're not going to pull back. According to Attorney General DeWine, as I said, he said that there were 22 members of the Attorney General's office, and that includes BCI, there today. And it was sort of they're going to continue to go 24/7 for as long as they need to go.
We will continue our review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon as we review the local news stories of the week, Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, 9 on Your Side, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. And you can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tana, let's turn our attention to what's going on with Union Terminal and the Museum Center. Now, they're planning for renovating the structure. Where do things stand at this point?
They're still getting ready. They're still doing their investigatory work. They're on schedule and on budget, they like to say. That's been the update.
That's what they always say.
Every time, right? That's been the update. So they're on schedule to start with the work. They're going to close the two museums on the wings coming up here in a couple of months, I believe in July. And then they'll get going. They've mostly they've been starting the bidding process to get, you know, Turner's in charge of the project. But there's going to have to be so many different agencies and companies and architects and everything coming in and doing various different parts. So they're starting to bid out that work.
Yeah. Well, what are the wire officials saying they need to do this renovation?
Well, they've needed it for a long time. A lot of it's delayed maintenance, and water damage is really the big thing on this building. You know, in some ways, it wasn't necessarily built to withstand all of the water damage that it's taken. The ceiling tile, the roof, you know, the dome roof, you can see they say that's in fine condition. However, the water has gotten under that into the actual roof, and there's just a lot of deterioration under there. So a lot of water damage repair work. A lot of the windows that were replaced in the 80s when they did that renovation allowed a lot of seepage. So there's a lot of water damage around anywhere there's a window. And the latest thing they found was they did a 3D laser scan.
So they're doing this preparatory stuff ahead of time.
Oh, yeah, this is all.
Okay.
They're trying to find as much as they can beforehand. I mean, a lot of the problems they knew existed. That's why, obviously, they ran the levee. But they're finding more, and they're trying to find out as much now before they actually start the work, so the fewer surprises along the way. That's the idea. So they did this 3D laser scan of the dome and determined that something called the drum wall, which is I'm going to really not sound scientific here, but it's that wall that's right underneath the roof that you can see, you know, the dome there. It kind of supports that. There's some structural issues in that. So they're going to have to basically take down all the brick, go in and fix the wall, shore it up because it's kind of out of alignment right now. And then, you know, obviously re-brick it back up.
So I guess in the meantime, they're going to keep looking around and seeing if they can find anything else that could be wrong.
Oh, yeah. They'll keep doing that until, you know, they really get in there. And you can't find everything, obviously, but they're hoping to find as much as possible now.
Well, what's the total price tag for doing this renovation?
About $212 million is where we stand right now.
And are they funding this solely with the levy? Or
That's $170 million of it.
Okay, so no, they're not.
That's what they're expecting. So no, a lot of it's come from you know, benefactors, donors. And they're also hoping for a lot of it to be covered by historic preservation tax credits. So they've applied. They've got both their applications in that for the federal tax credits and for the state ones. The federal ones they're feeling pretty good about. They should hear about that in August, I believe. And the state ones, you only get one state one. Only one agency can win the state credits in 1 year. So those can be very competitive. Obviously, the state has fewer dollars, fewer credits to hand out. But if the good news is, if they don't get it this year, you know, then they can apply again and apply again. And so they feel confident about the status of the building as being a fairly big project. So they're
and
feeling
it'll
good.
Still be historic next year.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Probably. That'd be my guess.
Yeah. So they're feeling good that they'll get their credits.
Do you know if I've followed this over the years, mm-hmm. you know, and so there was a problem with the steel beneath all that limestone. The steel is rusting, pushing the limestone out. At least this was the explanation I heard several years ago. But then I haven't seen any explanation on these, you know, what's going to be happening with the renovation project. I haven't seen any explanation for how they're going to address that issue. Are they, do you know if they have a major, like, you know, rust prevention type program going?
I do believe they have something in mind, whatever it is. I'm uncertain. Yeah. I mean, they've got lots of schematics. They don't have the final plan yet, but they do have a lot of schematics they just came out with. On Tuesday, the Union Terminal Restoration Advisory Committee had their meeting. And so I believe actually today is when they're supposed to make public this big plan. And they showed kind of a preliminary blueprint of it, which looks like the building. And all over the building where it's mapped out in blueprint style, there's little pins dropped in. It says, here's what we're doing here. Here's what we're doing here. So that might address some of those questions. They're already starting to do some work on the exterior, pulling off the limestone. The bulk of that front just has to get cleaned to, you know, make sure it doesn't continue to break down. But the plan is, I believe, supposed to be released today.
Well, what does this mean for museum members? I mean, will any parts of the museum stay open during the renovation work?
The plan is to keep the Children's Museum open the entire time and the special exhibits area open the entire time. They're getting ready for the Da Vinci exhibit to come in there, so they're very excited about that. Now, it's possible those two sections might also have to close for like a month or something like that, but they would push that into their slow time September if they were to have to do that, not this September, but probably the following one. It's a two-year project. And then I guess we should say, we'll give a nod to Chris's paper there. Dan had a story, not you, Dan. Dan Horn had a story. They've just laid off about probably 60 employees, which was not part of the original plan. Originally, they had planned to keep everybody on, but they're saying now that doesn't make fiscal sense, so they're going to have to lay off.
And this is because they're going to lose some revenue during
the
time
they're going to lose revenue.
Of the building were closed.
Right, so the History Museum and the Cincinnati Museum will be closed.
And then what happens to, I'm sorry, what happens to the exhibits that were there? Will they be, I heard early on that they were going to place some of sort of the stuff that you could see throughout the community. Is that still the plan, do you know?
I believe there's something in the works on that, but they're not saying what yet.
Oh, okay.
So Tanner, that's why
I don't know much.
Yeah, they're starting to box things up and they're looking for places to put it all. And they've got, you know, they've got the Geyer Center where they store a lot of their stuff off site right now. They're looking for storage. They've rented out some storage in there. I do believe there's a plan along the lines of you mentioned, but they're not talking yet.
You've mentioned the time frame, kind of in bits and pieces. Kind of lay out straight for me. When is the work starting? When do they expect it's going to be finished?
So this summer, they're on track to really begin the work. The final budget will be approved by commissioners in August, mid-August. They're expected to vote on it. This is the guaranteed price that Turner gives them. So they're doing it as a private partnership, a private-public partnership sort of setup. So they'll give a final price then. Commissioners will sign off on that. And then they'll shut down those two museums, like I said, I think in July, and then the work just kind of goes for 2 years, and they're planning to reopen in the fall of 2018.
Okay, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our discussion in this news review. And Dan, let's talk about what's going on with the Cincinnati VA Medical Center, the allegations against them and so forth, and the leadership changes they've gone through. But start with a little background. WCPO.com has been covering this very extensively. How did this come to your attention?
Well, a group of inside, whistleblowers, current and former employees, approached us because they said they had been all the way through the management chain within the VA. They had reached out to members of Congress, and they couldn't get anybody to address some issues that they thought were pretty serious in that hospital. So we took it on like in November of last year, ended up writing a bunch of stories in February. Two of the big stories had to do with cost-cutting, some managerial misconduct issues, and then also some quality of care issues, including operating room problems where equipment was not properly sterilized, according to these whistleblowers. So that led to two federal investigations and four leadership changes since mid-February. And still, we don't have final answers from either the Office of Medical Inspector, which is a VA investigative body, or the Office of Inspector General, which is a more independent VA-affiliated investigative agency. They have referred some information to criminal prosecution or possible criminal prosecution, but the chief of staff, who was who would have been targgeted in an investigation, has been told by the DEA that she will not be prosecuted for this prescription problem. She, according to our reporting, prescribed controlled substances for the wife of her former boss. And when the VA came in and investigated, that was the first thing they substantiated. And then referred it. The DEA ended up not prosecuting her, and she has relinquished her DEA registration, which means that she can't prescribe controlled substances. Right now, she still works for the VA, and she is paid the same salary she was before, but she's no longer in management. She no longer has hospital privileges. She doesn't have prescription authority. She's doing paperwork, basically.
How is all of this that's going on, how is it affecting the day-to-day care of vets? Is it?
Well, the hospital keeps saying no. and every new leader that shows up there says it's a well-run organization and delivers great care to veterans. They care about veterans. They care about being transparent. They care about listening to their employees. And then you continue to hear from employees that nothing has changed. Everything is, basically as it was in February, just with new people in charge.
We had somebody who was brought in this week, actually, to be the, the third acting director they've had since all this occurred. Tell me about this new leader.
He replaced a medical center director who's been there since August. He was one of four leadership changes. So this new guy's name is Glenn Costi. He comes from the Dayton VA, and he's a little bit of a troubleshooter, I guess, within the VA system. He went to Phoenix after they had their wait time scandal. He arrived in Dayton after they had a scandal, and he helped them recover from that. So he's been off and on for 5 years in Dayton. Now he's in Cincinnati and had very little to say about what problems he thinks he can solve. At this local VA, he says he's here to communicate with employees, listen to employees, and be transparent.
Okay, so that's his plan.
Yeah, that's his plan, right. So they've also replaced a regional network director, Jack Hetrick, the person who left after Dr. Tomek, after they substantiated this allegation involving Dr. Tomek. Jack Hetrick left. And there's a new guy named Robert McDivitt, who comes from the Michigan VA. He was a medical center director there, and now he is the network director for a three-state region.
Now, WCPO held a town hall. Mm-hmm. Regarding what kind of response did you get to that town hall on the Cincinnati VA?
A lot of angry people, a lot of angry veterans. The VA used to do these public forums, these town hall meetings. And they got away from it because, what I've been told by folks at the VA is that the same people would show up at every hearing and kind of dominate the conversation and complain about their private personal issues. And you couldn't really get anything done. So they've been experimenting with different kinds of public formats. Well, I think the veterans don't like that. They want their voices heard. They want to be able to confront the people who are running the system. And so when we held this thing, we really didn't know how many people would show up. And it turned out we got about 100 veterans there. And no shortage of issues were raised that night, including some of this conversation about whether or not surgical instruments are, clean and whether they have a problem with sterilization in the hospital. We had two speakers that night who said they witnessed it. And they want to know why something hasn't been done.
So how seriously is Congress taking this? Are there any indications that Congress is going to step in and look into this?
There are indications that Congress is paying attention. Sherrod Brown was here at Glenn Costi's debut press conference on the 2nd, and he has been following this pretty closely, claims that he we got a statement from his office when Costi was identified as the new medical center director, and he praised the change. And we got a statement from his office indicating that Brown has been calling Bob McDonald and other VA leaders, McDonald being the former Cincinnati P&G CEO, who is now the VA secretary, calling VA leaders daily, if not weekly. Weekly, if not daily, I think that's the – yeah. And basically pushing for more change at that hospital. So I know that Sherrod Brown's paying attention. Brad Wenstrup also sent a letter to the VA secretary just a week or so ago demanding a better explanation for why Costi came in as a new leader and John Gennaro was reassigned to Pennsylvania. They still haven't given what I would consider a detailed explanation for why this change is being made now. They haven't tied it to any of these investigations. And all they're saying is that, the VA is a system and sometimes we need to move our managers around to better serve veterans.
So where's your coverage of this headed?
Well, we're still looking into a lot of these allegations. We've probably written about I don't know, a half dozen. And after we interviewed folks back in November, we had a list of probably three dozen. So there's a lot of issues that warrant further exploration. And so we're trying to keep track of the federal probes that are happening, trying to get an idea of who they're talking to, how seriously they're taking it, whether they're actually investigating or whether they're just trying to make some changes and move on, you know, with life. So,
Tanda, let's talk too before we finish up this part of the segment. We have a celebration of life that's going to be going on this afternoon at Vineyard Cincinnati, and that's for Cincinnati firefighter Jordan Panasek, who was killed Sunday after he was struck on his motorcycle while riding to work. How are his fellow firefighters remembering him? What do they have to say about what kind of person he was?
Well, his assistant chief, the new assistant chief, said on Monday when they were discussing it that he was a great ambassador for the city. When he would go out on the runs, he didn't care who you were or where you were from. You were going to get the best care possible from him. And he, you know, always had something good to say to people. He was a good man. He was a good firefighter and, you know, a good father and husband is what they were saying.
Yeah, now he was killed while he was off duty, struck by a car.
Right. So, you know, there are some questions about that since he was off duty, but he was on his way to work. So that's a big difference in terms of what financial benefits might be going to his family. So that is one of the things that they're looking at.
They're trying to resolve. Mm-hmm. And then we have 24-year-old Patrick Tucker, is it, who's been Correct. Charged in this case? What are the charges against him? Where's his case stand?
My understanding, based on looking at the inmate record, he must have posted bond. He's charged with, I believe now it's four counts. They're all under the same criminal statute, though, of negligent homicide and vehicular homicide, negligent vehicular manslaughter. This is, my understanding, is up to about 6 months is what he would be looking to if charged with that. And they're not saying yet what led to the crash. He went left of center. They know that. So they've got four charges that involve, you know, that kind of driving infraction. They've ruled out drugs and alcohol as a cause. Now, his attorney has told media that distracted driving has been ruled out, but I just spoke with the police lieutenant in charge of the investigation prior to coming on this show, and he said, well, that's his opinion, Mr. Tucker's attorney's opinion, but he said we've not ruled out some kind of distraction possibly. And you know, he was obviously very vague about it because the investigation is still ongoing.
But they say that they don't think in either case that drugs or alcohol.
Drugs or alcohol do not appear to have been involved.
So
he's no criminal record, according to his attorney, college graduate, 24-year-old man.
So at this point, bond's been set for Patrick Tucker? Is that right?
Well, bond was set yesterday at his hearing, but I think he's posted bond. He's not listed as being in the criminal justice system at the moment. So.
Okay. Thank you, Tana. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you
for joining me this afternoon. Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, 9 on Your Side, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. Coming up, we'll have a conversation with John Keysweater about the memorial service for Channel 12 weatherman Tim Hedrick. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining us now, WVXU radio and TV writer John Keysweater, here to talk to us about the passing of Channel 12 meteorologist Tim Hedrick. And John, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. He was a great guy. I was one of the many who got to know him over his years at Channel 12.
Yeah, it's impressive, John, isn't it, how many lives he touched. I'm just always amazed by that.
Well, you know, he comes into your home every night, or any TV personality does, and so you figure you know him. But he was unusual. He had a wonderful gift that he was both a scientist and can communicate a forecast, his forecast. Plus, he could have fun and touch us on a very personal level too. You know, he did the grilling with Tim. He did one of my favorite was the Friday night football forecast where he'd do it with a bunch of kids at a high school stadium. And so he was very good on both fronts, and he really touched a lot of people in this community.
What's his entire career with Channel 12?
Most of it. He grew up in Illinois, went to Iowa State,
and was working at WHO in Des Moines, and was looking for a full time to be a chief meteorologist somewhere. And he told me, actually, it was in the first interview he did with me back when he came here in 88. I put it on the WVXU website 2 days ago. That he said he was looking, he wanted to be a chief, and he only wanted to look at four cities because it had they had interesting weather. It was St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas City, and Cincinnati. And he got the offer to come here as a chief meteorologist, 1988. He was only 27, and he spent most of his life here.
Interesting weather. I guess that would be true about Cincinnati, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, and you know, when he came here, people forget because there's so many meteorologists on TV. But when he came here in 1988, you had personalities doing the weather. Pat Barry on Channel 5, Bob Allen on Channel 9, and actually, when Tim came here in 88 on the early news, the weather guy was Ira Joe Fisher back.
Oh yeah,
with this, you know, the backwards writing, lovable weatherman. But none of them were meteorologists, and so he, in this market, started the trend of having a meteorologist at night, not a TV personality, and the TV station soon began to brand him as the weather authority. But he had the forecast, he had the respect that people did tune to him. I mean, you just look at the ratings. That ratings always jump in times of severe weather, but they really would jump to Channel 12 because people turned to Tim Hedrick for his forecast and the way he could communicate it in a severe storm.
Now, John, there was a memorial service for Tim last evening, and you attended that service. What was it like?
There was about 1,000 people. The entire floor of the Cintas Center was filled mostly with people from Channel 12 or friends of the station or past employees. And then there was, by my rough count, probably about 1,000 people there all together. And it was an upbeat celebration of his life. In fact, there's only two pictures of him on the stage, and one was him, that big life-size cardboard cutout of Grilling with Tim. So they wanted to make it upbeat. A lot of nice clips of him from the opening day parade, Grilling with Tim. He did a bicycle collection at the Kenwood Town Center once for a charity. There were a lot of pictures of him on a loop on the Jumbotron and James Taylor Music. That was his favorite artist. And one of the things that came through was almost everybody who worked with him that spoke talked about his family and how he was a family man and how he would go home at supper. You know, when you're working 3 to midnight, he would go home for supper to his family out in the Oak Hill School District in Green Township, and he took time to coach his kids' basketball teams. And the people who worked with him said, "You know, if we had a family issue come up or need some time off, family." His motto was "Family first. Go tend to your family," and that's the way he lived his life. And that was one of the lessons his coworkers said they take home with him.
Yeah, how unusual do you think was Tim's relationship with viewers, you know, as a throwback to the early days of TV? Ruth Lyons, Tony Sands, Bob Braun, those kind of folks?
Well, most of those grew up here. And as in the current anchors here, you know, Rob Braun grew up here. Tammy Durkin grew up here. Steve Horschmeyer. Well, Hedrick was a special case in that after he was here for a while, I've said it several times, that he was probably a TV personality in my 30-plus years covering TV. But he was here so much and became one of us that people thought he grew up here. The people would ask him,
that's what I always thought, too, yeah.
Or St. X, or did you go to West High or Oak Hills or whatever? And to me, that's the highest compliment, because there's people who have come here, tried to establish themselves and it just didn't work, you know, or moved on to another market, a Pat Menarson or Deborah Silverstein. And people who've come here use it as a stepping stone and moved off. And he stayed here, and he was here, and we accepted him and embraced him as one of us, so much so that he was, that we thought he was one of us. And to me, that's the highest compliment of somebody coming to this market and being one of us.
Hey, John, do you know the story behind Grilling with Tim, how that got started?
Yes, I do. Some people in the station weren't familiar with it. I actually found it in one of my old stories. I asked him once, and he said, well, back in the early 90s, we're guessing about 91, he did a weather forecast, and he was grilling a pot roast with Italian dressing on his deck at his home, and just as a shtick or something to do. And he said he was amazed at the response from the viewers because people started calling the station and saying, well, what's he going to grill next? So that became this regular shtick of grilling with Tim or grilling something out, and then it became an event where he cooked for 200 people at a public grounds or in somebody's yard or at a park or something. And it was just genius that he came upon that as a way to connect with so many people.
So how big would you say is how big of a loss to the community is his death? What would you say, John?
Well, you know, he like I said, he was one of the iconic personalities. He was probably the number one personality in this market. You know, going forward, and once we get past the mourning period and get past the loss of our friend, you know, Channel 12 has some really tricky questions to make. They've got to replace an icon. And it could be somebody on staff. It could be a former employee they bring in. I don't know. It's somebody on staff, and it changes somebody else's duties from another newscast. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. It's not an enviable task that the people at Channel 12 have to replace somebody who is so hugely popular and so singularly identified with that station to be their chief meteorologist.
Yeah, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, the one thing about Tim is that, you know, there was no hype. When Channel 5 started the Power of Five radars and they had five radar sweeps going on, he and I were exchanging some emails and he signed it. He closed the email by saying, "The power of one!" exclamation point, because he believed in his own Doppler radar that he was using at the time. And, you know, he wasn't into hype and you know, there was once a case where the news director at Channel 5 had ordered their chief meteorologist to declare a blizzard when it was just a snowstorm. He never went into that. He just told you what it was very plainly, plain, succinctly. But when he got agitated or when he said, hey, this is bad, go, turn off the TV, get to the basement, find shelter, you knew it was serious. But before then, he wouldn't hype anything. And I think that was the other reason that he was so well-respected and had such a huge following.
Yeah, a lot of trust. I think that was the biggest quality, John. Yeah, a lot of trust.
When there's a big weather coming, you know, I'd go to him. I'd go to him first. I might check out the other meteorologists, the other stations, see what they're saying, but I'd go to him first. I don't know about yourself.
Yep. John, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. WVXU radio and TV writer John Keysweater.